And I think it's actually really liberating that there are so many degrees now, even though, of course, everybody that does those degrees isn't going to be a published writer. It somehow takes the mystique out of it, that actually it's just about turning up.
Welcome to In Writing with Hattie Crissell, and today's guest is Anna Hope. I first discovered Anna via her most recent novel, Expectation, a story of three 30-something women grappling with the disappointments of adult life. Very resonant with this 30-something woman, and I wasn't surprised that it was very well received. She's also published two historical novels, Wake and The Ballroom. What I find particularly interesting about Anna, though, is her personal story. Her first career was as an actress, and it was when she became disillusioned by the process of auditioning and the long periods working in a call centre that she started taking creative writing courses. The first novel she wrote was close to being published but didn't quite make it, and she talks about what that was like in this episode. She overcame a lot before finding success, and I don't think I'll be the only person who finds her story very inspiring. Anna lives in a village in Sussex. The taxi driver who picked me up from the station warned me that it was full of lefties and hippies. And she has perhaps the most interesting study of anyone I interviewed in this series, a purpose-built cabin at the bottom of her garden. It was icy on the day that I visited her in December, and she laughed at my high-heeled boots and made me change into some practical shoes before we made our way down there. That cabin also had a predecessor, a shed that Anna's husband built her in their previous garden in London, and she also talks about the joy of first moving into that. So, over to Anna. Tell me a little bit about this space.
It's, I think you just described it as being a bit like a Swedish sauna.
Yeah, it does look like a Swedish sauna.
It's very woody. It's sort of, it's quite curved in its shape, which I really like. It sort of looks like a segment of something, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does.
A curved roof.
It's a sort of quarter circle shape.
And some rustic shelves. And it's at the bottom of my garden, which is quite damp, but very, very sort of, it does feel very private and away from the world, which is a joy.
It's incredibly peaceful here.
Yeah, it is, isn't it? We're on the edge of a Sussex village, and behind us is the Ashdown Forest, which goes on for miles and miles and miles and miles.
Yeah, and it gets you out of the house and allows you to properly focus on being creative.
Yeah, I mean, I remember when I had the shed, because the first novel I wrote was a novel that wasn't published, but I wrote it in my kitchen, in my basement flat in Hackney. And then to be able to go to the shed and have all these sort of post-it notes up and have the kind of inner workings of my mind and my work there and not disturbed was just the most extraordinary thing, to then walk back into that space every morning and still be there.
Yeah.
After I'd worked in, you know, I worked a lot in the British Library as well, and obviously that's very different because you're not surrounded by that in the same way. And yeah, it's a luxury. It's wonderful.
It's lovely. And it's quite minimalist, or I don't know whether that's because you're not writing currently, maybe there are more things up on the walls when you are, but at the moment it's really just desk, some books, a heater. I mean,
yeah, that's all I have. In fact, I did an event last week and they were asking what sort of special things I have on my desk to help me to write, and I mean, I would usually have my desktop down here, my computer. What I look onto would be peppered with post-its, which would be the structure of the novel.
Okay, so yeah. You are somebody who does quite a lot of structuring on paper before you sit down and write.
No, I'm not. In fact, I'm the opposite. So that happens, that post-it stage happens after the first draft. So the first draft for me is completely unplanned. And I'm actually quite superstitious about that now. I think really sort of magic things can happen when I don't plan. and it keeps it very alive and very exciting, actually, to kind of come down here and not know what's going to happen. But then, of course, all of the work after the first draft is about trying to kind of find that structure that wasn't necessarily there in the first draft. And so that's when the post-its come out, and that's when, you know, and that's when I might turn to a book. I mean, I've got some books on kind of structure and plot, and I might read them kind of diagnostically if there are things that feel like they're not working. But yeah, I certainly keep all of that well away from the first draft. That feels really crucial. I remember doing a screenwriting module on the masters that I did and being like, oh my God, you know, plot, sort of dirty plot, like it's so cheap. And because I, you know, the writers that I really loved were modernist writers, but it was an incredibly helpful module, actually. And I still kind of think back to it and think, God, that really did kind of give me some idea of story structure. I mean, he taught it through film, but for somebody that had never thought about plot in relation to novels, it was really, really...
It's funny to hear that, because helpful. I think your books are so beautifully structured and quite intricately structured, and things sort of gradually weave together without quite the reader even noticing, and then by the end it's there are much clearer links between characters and plot lines. So I think that's one of your strengths. It's funny to hear that you didn't initially think it was going to be something you were that interested in.
Far from it, in fact. But then again, you know, if I think of like the modernist books that I really love, if I think of something like Mrs. Dalloway, it's actually incredibly structured, right?
Right.
It takes place over a day, and you know, and those characters are very intricately interwoven. It's so interesting. It's so interesting, this kind of relationship that I think particularly novelists have with structure. I think it can feel almost kind of shameful to kind of talk about it. I know certain sorts of writers, genre writers, you know, really think that way first, often, don't they? They think in terms of the structure first. I'm the other way around. But yeah, no, in, I mean, with Wake, for instance, which is kind of incredibly sort of plotted, I guess.
Yeah, your first novel.
Yeah. I had no idea how those characters, what their relationship was. I knew there would be a kind of a causal relationship, you know, something that kind of triggered the whole kind of going back in time, you know, but I had no idea what it was going to be until I was staying with my mum and dad in Manchester, and a young man knocked on the door. He'd just come out of prison and he was selling sort of dishcloths and stuff, and I heard his voice at the door, and I felt this sort of, yeah, there was just that sense of, oh gosh, this might, what if somebody knocked at somebody's door under the pretext of selling something, but actually, yeah. And that was all I had. I just had this sort of image, and wow. It kind of went from there.
So what is your writing routine? You said that you come down first thing in the morning, is that right?
Yeah, so I will drop my daughter off at nursery, and then I'll make a cup of coffee, and I'll come down here, and I'll just start. And I start by, so I have one working draft basically, but I save it every day with a different date.
Oh, so you save a new version?
Yeah.
Okay, so that you've got all of those previous drafts.
Exactly. So if I've done a big edit and I feel like something's missing, and I can, you know, say it's September, and I think, oh God, you know, I think I did a better version of that back in May, I'll tend to have a sort of vague idea, and I'll be able to look back and find a version of the scene. But yeah, so I come down and I open up yesterday's version, and then I go to where I left off, and I just start changing commas and, you know, and whatever it might be, just reading through the last paragraph, and I guess that's me warming myself back into it, and then I tend to be kind of away then. I'm not a writer that suffers from writer's block, touch wood, because if I reach a bit that I feel is sticky, I'll just put like bold caps, come back to this, or this sort of thing needs to happen here.
Oh, that's clever. So you don't get hung up on concentrating on that bit until you've perfected it. You leave a note and move on.
Yeah. I think ultimately I am, not a perfectionist, but I am really, really concerned that everything is working as well as it can do. I know some writers that cannot move on until they've got that scene or that sentence, you know, right, but I just can't work like that. I have to keep moving. And then I'll come back and see if I can tinker and over time. There are some scenes that I'll have rewritten like 117 times.
Really?
Oh God, yeah. And then there are some that are just exactly, they came out clean, and they didn't really change from first draft to the end of the book.
Yeah.
And I thought I would be less productive with a small child, and I think I just was more productive, actually.
That's interesting. Why is that?
I think it's just that sense in which you don't have any other time. It's these 4 hours and that's it. And so I would just like go for it in those 4 hours. And I sort of really enjoyed that, actually. The kind of extreme, quite brutal focus of that, you know.
Yeah.
That's all you're getting in a day. And then also, you know, that inevitable, you're with my daughter and, you know, stuff will be kind of like working at the back of my mind, you know. And so by the time I got back to the desk, I would have stored up quite a lot of work then for when I came back to the desk in the morning. So
do you find yourself sort of making notes on your phone or anything through the day to make sure you don't lose those thoughts?
Yeah, I do, actually. And I did that a lot more since having my daughter. And what I would also do is I started on reading Kindle when I started breastfeeding. I thought I'd never read a Kindle, but then when you're up in the middle of the night and you don't want to disturb other people, it's actually a really great way to read. And I did loads and loads of reading while doing night feeds. And so that then became a thing to kind of read on my Kindle, and I would, you know, email a draft to myself, read on my Kindle, and that again was really helpful because that's just a different way of reading, a different screen, it feels as though you're reading a book, and so the kind of the editing mind is I think slightly sharper.
I think that's so interesting because as a journalist, I've noticed that if I'm really stuck on a draft of an article, often then reading it on a different screen or printing it out and reading it on paper, it's as though it wakes your brain up in a way and you can see it afresh.
Yeah.
It's really odd.
It is odd. And I think that there are different sort of, maybe there are different neurons for the Kindle edit, you know, to the neurons that we use for the paper edit, because the paper edit is more tactile and I write all over the paper edit, but the Kindle edit feels slightly closer to the finished book because that's where I'm used to reading novels now, actually. So and then I would, as I was reading on the Kindle, I would make notes on my phone, and then I'd email myself the notes from my phone, and then I'd have them when I came down to the cabin in the morning. So I guess the work it's not just confined to those 4 hours, but
You studied English at Oxford.
Yeah.
But then you went to RADA and you trained to be an actor. So at what point did you then come to writing?
So I left RADA when I was 26, and I was an actor, primarily an actor, until I was sort of 32. I mean, I didn't get my book deal until I was 37. So it was a decade of being an actor. But in that decade, you know, I sort of bumped further and further down the food chain. Wrote a lot about that in Expectation, which was quite cathartic, actually. I didn't do badly as an actor. I had some really great jobs, but I had a huge amount of time unemployed or, you know, doing kind of those other jobs, which don't stimulate your brain. And so I had a huge amount of creative frustration in that time, huge. And when I was about 30, everybody would always say to me, oh, you should write a one woman show, you should write your own material, or, you know, as I was sort of slogging away with some terrible script trying to convince myself that I really wanted to do it, or and I would always say, oh god, I just don't feel it, and it hadn't occurred to me to write fiction at all, actually. And then one day it did, and I did a short story course at City Lit, and I think I was about 31 32, and I actually had a sort of light bulb moment in a class. We had to write a story in the class, like in real time, and I wrote this story, and I was like, oh my god, you know, like, this is amazing, I love this. And I think it was a feeling of power is the wrong word, but, you know, when I found acting to be so fundamentally disempowering, actually.
Yeah.
I guess more than power, it was agency, sort of creative agency, that you could start something, finish it, and have something there, you know, that was done and somehow satisfying.
Nobody could stop you from doing this thing, unlike acting, where you sort of need somebody to sort of give you an opportunity to do it, I suppose.
Yeah, I mean, you need to be chosen. You need to, I mean, you know, what you go through to even, you know, you get the audition, you wait for the phone to ring from your agent, the phone rings, you've got an audition, great. Then you get the script, then you just spend, you know, you spend however long preparing for it, imagining yourself into the part, because if you don't do that work, then, you know, you're not going to show up, you're not going to get it. And so you do work really hard, and then you do it, and the audition, however it goes, you know, is emotionally taxing, and then you wait, and sometimes you get a call to say you haven't got it, sometimes you get a call to say you've got it, most often you hear nothing at all,
and it's horrible, it just ebbs and ebbs,
and then at a certain point you kind of recognize you're definitely not going to get that part, and, you know, that is really, really exhausting,
demoralizing.
It is, over time, it really is. I mean, obviously there are the high points where you get the roles, and it's fantastic, but the, you know, the waiting is corrosive, and so suddenly, like you say, yeah, there's this sense of like, oh my god, nobody gave me permission to do this, I just did it, and it felt actually kind of quite subversive as well. And I think writing on some level still feels subversive, because it's such a deep joy, actually, it's such a pleasure, you know, and the solitude is so incredibly rich and wonderful, and that it feels like, am I allowed to have this much fun, pleasure, you know, but it's not quite fun, but like deep pleasure, I
satisfaction.
Think satisfaction, yeah. Just like, yeah, love of work, you know, it feels like such a rich gift, actually. Yeah.
And you did quite a few, well, you did a few courses, didn't, is that right?
So I did courses at City Lit in London. I did one short story course, I did two short story courses there, and then I did a master's at Birkbeck, which was fantastic, actually. I wasn't sure, because I had no money at the time and it wasn't cheap, and I was thinking, you know, is it going to be worth it? And it was so worth it. It was wonderful.
I'm really interested in that, actually, in your experience of learning about writing and how it shaped you as a writer. I mean, do you think that you could have written the three great novels that you've written if you hadn't done that studying?
I'm not sure I could. I mean, in a way, it might have been inevitable that I would have become a writer, actually. I mean, having done it now, it feels as though it fits me so well. But it helped hugely. I mean, I remember the professor at the beginning of the course saying, you know, you can call yourself writers from here on in, and me just kind of going, whatever, you know, we're not writers, you know. But actually, over time, that started to feel like it might be a possibility. And what was great about Birkbeck, what is great about Birkbeck, is that they teach in the evening, and so you get all sorts of people who've got all sorts of jobs, and it's not just sort of, you know, people straight after university in their mid-20s. The age range is really, really varied, and people's backgrounds are really varied, and we had we have still a fantastic writers group that met there and carried on meeting and reading work and workshopping. And you know, the workshop format is really interesting because you get used to critical feedback, and you know, it's a powerful experience. I think it helped me hugely to believe in myself as a writer, and as they say, things that I didn't expect, actually, like a short screenwriting course, which I didn't even do that well in, which I'm not sure that I even really got at the time, you know, but actually forcing us to think about structure in quite a sort of schematic way was just so new, you know. And I think there was so much about the course that helped me, but then of course you have to then just make sure that you are turning up every day at the desk and
doing the work.
I mean, the amount of self-belief that it takes to write a first draft when you have absolutely no idea if it's ever going to get published is,
god, yeah. And it's a huge emotional effort apart from all of the actual work, I think.
Yeah, but again, you know, like, deep joy, I think, for me, you know, just the sort of frustration and the sense of you know, god, am I ever gonna... I remember doing The Artist's Way. I don't know if you...
Oh, yeah, I love The Artist's Way. Yeah, Julia Cameron.
Yeah, I'm writing in the mornings, like, will I ever feel creative flow? You know, because I'd just be like, you know, you get a part on a, you know, on a film or TV, and it's sort of 5 days and they're so separate, and there was never a sense that you could string something together, you know. But I remember writing the first novel that I wrote, which didn't actually get published, but got me an agent and got very close to getting published. You know, just that sense of flow was just amazing. Like, oh my god, I can just keep going with this thing.
Yeah.
How extraordinary.
Is that... you mentioned writing groups and, you know, getting critical feedback from other writers. Is that sort of writing community important to you still?
Yeah, I mean, less so now. I've moved out of London and I've got a daughter, because it's just harder for me to get up to London.
Yeah.
You know, we did really well as a group. We met weekly for, I would say, 8 years, and then fortnightly for another couple of years. Now it's more like monthly, but people do still meet in London, and we, you know, we turn up for each other's big events, you know, and we're friends as much as we're fellow writers. And I mean, I can't really say enough about how grateful I am to that group of people. We call ourselves the Unwritables. and we, yeah, I mean, the support and the kind of the, you know, the everybody became much better writers, but also much better readers, I think, and editors of each other's work. And because there was such a sort of circle of trust established over many, many years, I mean, I know that there's certain people within that group, you know, who I can ask to read a draft of my novel in an early stage, and there are very few people that I would feel comfortable asking that, but that, you know, within that group there are still... I mean, I could ask any one of them, actually, but yeah, they're just really phenomenal people, readers and writers. So yeah, it's hugely important to me. Yeah.
Tell me a little bit about your first book that got you the agent but wasn't published. What was that experience like?
Yeah, it was... well, the experience of writing it was joyous. I got my wonderful agent, who I still have today, Caroline Wood, she worked with me on it. It was a novel about the suffragette. It was about a young woman. It was a bit of a mashup of... I was really interested in the Victorian spiritualist movement and how working class women had emancipated themselves through kind of holding these seances. It was such a sort of strange little pocket of history, and I was really interested in exploring that. And I'd sort of yoked that to this suffragette story, and it was a friendship between Ella and Clem. So she's from Yorkshire, and Clem is this young woman, proto-feminist in London. And the elements didn't quite marry up. But there was a really lovely editor at Faber who was really interested in buying it, but it didn't get through acquisitions. And that was really hard because obviously in retrospect, I can see what was wrong with it. But at the time I was really living in it, and I felt like, oh my God, what have I done? You know, here was this, as I say, this place of joy and pleasure and creative expansion, and I've kind of brought it to the marketplace. It's been rejected, having spent all these years being rejected as an actor, and you know, and now what? This is the pattern of my life. I should just go and do something else. I should go and retrain as a teacher. I remember I was doing a play in Bury St Edmunds when I got the news, and it was pretty devastating actually. And I did consider, you know, doing a PGCE, but then what happened, I remember it was kind of, I finished the play and then it was November time. It was sort of around this time of year. And I had an idea for another novel, for Wake. And my husband woke me up. I think he'd given me like a month. And he woke me up and he'd brought me a cup of coffee in my Virginia Woolf Room of One's Own mug. And he was like, get up, write another book.
Oh, that's so nice. You're lucky to have him.
Yeah. And he also, amazingly, because he'd seen how sort of dedicated I've become to my writing practice, he said that he would pay the rent on our little flat so that I didn't have to work in the call centre that I was working in, and I could just concentrate on, I mean, I still did a couple of shifts, but mainly I just concentrated on writing in the morning. And that carried on through the time that I wrote Wake. And that was not an easy process either. I mean, I would write draft after draft that didn't work, and my agent, who is phenomenally rigorous and brilliantly insightful, would read them and say, something is still not working. And you know, it was right to the sort of wire with that book. And then she read a draft and she phoned me and she said, it's ready to go out. And it went out. Yeah, it went out on a Tuesday.
It's so nerve-wracking after what you'd been through with the first one.
It was high stakes. And it went out on a Tuesday, and I remember working in the call centre and seeing a missed call from her and just going, oh my God. And then going into the little breakout room, and she said, yeah, there's a preempt from a publisher, but it looks like it was going to go to auction. And then there was a 7-way auction, and that was just like, my life changed, you know. So
that's incredible. And so that book was Wake, which is set in the aftermath of the First World War, and it follows three women who are all dealing in different ways with what's been left by the First World War. And as you say, it sold easily, it was well reviewed, it was shortlisted for awards, it's published overseas, and that was your debut. So I mean, what was that? That must have been incredible.
Yeah, I mean, it was. It was incredible. I think the most incredible thing is the validation that actually what you're doing, this thing that brings so much pleasure, the act of writing, is meeting readers and living in their minds and hearts. And you know, I mean, that is extraordinary. And then what that then means is it, I can carry on doing this thing, you know, which is, yeah, it continues to be a dream come true, actually.
Oh, that's so nice.
Yeah.
So that and your second novel, The Ballroom, they're both historical fiction. What do you think draws you to that as a genre?
Well, I love, I mean, I sort of wished I'd studied history at university. I mean, I love the research. I love the sense of kind of having several different relationships to text at the same time. So there's, you know, I love the secondary reading, and also kind of a relationship to kind of place and history is really important. So Wake was very much a London novel, and The Ballroom's very much a sort of Yorkshire novel. And so I'm sort of fascinated in social history. I'm fascinated by those by those pockets of history that have maybe been overlooked.
Then your third novel is a modern story, a contemporary story, Expectation. Also wonderful in a different way. It's about these three friends whose lives sort of haven't panned out quite as they expected. What brought you to that story?
Well, I think just from our chat, you can hear that.
Well, there is an actress, isn't there? Lissa is the character who's been trying to get an acting. Well, she has been acting for some time, but with lots of frustration.
Yeah, that. But also, I think the sense in which I know I lived through my early to mid 30s with none of the markers of, you know, a traditional adult life. I mean, obviously, you know, that's changing massively. I think for the generation below mine, it's things are so much more precarious. So it even feels like a sort of like, it might even be a kind of throwback to say that I even had those expectations of what an adult life would be in my early to mid 30s. But for me, I guess it was that I would have a home, you know, that I would have been able to buy my own house, that I wouldn't have been working in call centres, you know, that I would have made some sort of success out of my career because I'd trained hard and I'd worked hard. And none of those things had happened, you know. And then also I started trying to become a mother and suffered, you know, many, many losses, many miscarriages. And so it just felt like a kind of a compounding of this sense of not being where I had hoped that I would be in every realm, really, of my life. Meanwhile, I had this sort of, you know, secret stash of joy, which was that I was able to kind of channel it all into writing. But nothing had breached the waterline, you know, as far as I knew. I might never be published, you know, and I was still living on soup mix and, you know, just trying to get by. So I had a lot to draw on, you know, when writing about that period in our lives. I think when I took stock and I think was quite surprised at the sort of level of surprised by wanting things that I hadn't. I feel like I'm contradicting myself here because in a way I'm saying that I thought that I was going to have those things, but I'd also lived quite happily without them.
Yeah.
I'd lived a kind of precarious life quite happily, and then suddenly I wanted these things with a ferocity that really surprised me. So I, you know, having thought that I would be able to have a child when I was ready, I started trying to get pregnant when I was 34, and then, you know, a year later, and it was like, oh my God, this might never happen. And it sort of overtook my life, and in the end it took me 7 years to have a child. But there was a reason for that, which was that I had a blood clotting disorder which was only diagnosed, you know, 6 years after the, so yeah. But I mean, it was very rich psychic terrain, actually, and so I had a lot to draw on, and it was interesting because I was originally going to write another historical novel set in 17th century. And then, you know, I had a small baby, having, you know, wanted to have a child so much. And then also kind of recognizing how extremely full on it is to have a small child and try and be a creative person. And, you know, all of those kind of new conflicts, which I hadn't anticipated. So that also went into the book. And I thought, yeah, I kind of want to write about all of this.
Yeah, I think it's incredibly relatable subject matter, and you've hit the nail on the head with how so many women feel that somehow their lives have slightly gone off map and they don't quite know where they're supposed to be and how to get there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, thanks. It's interesting talking about it. I've found it quite difficult. I found it the most difficult of my books to talk about. I think because it's so autobiographical in so many ways. And I'm really happy to talk about that, actually. But then it can be difficult then when talking about that to sort of get back on to talking about craft and talking about, you know, what it took to kind of bring it into a book, because, you know, I might be everywhere in a book like Wake.
Of course, but it would be less.
But nobody looks for you
to
there.
A reader, yeah.
Yeah, and nobody asks you about that. And yeah, it's been a really interesting process. But I think, you know, it's that thing of when you do write something which is so specific, actually, then the more specific it is, not necessarily to the circumstances of my life, because, you know, these women are not me, but the more, as you say, relatable hopefully it is. Because if I'd tried to write a book that was generally about what happens to women in their mid-30s, then it probably wouldn't
hit home in quite the same way.
I just tried to be as honest as possible about those kind of unpleasant feelings, like, you know, envy as well. And you know, I was surprised at the level at which I envied my friends. I mean, I found it very, very difficult to, you know, struggle so much to have a child when, you know, people were having children with not much difficulty.
What are some of the lessons that you've learned about writing over the years that have really improved your own writing?
It's a really good question. That you can only find your rhythm and pattern yourself, and that probably takes a bit of time, you know. I mean, I used to think that working in libraries was what you did, but actually I that's not what I need. I need to be really alone. And I'm fortunate that I can find that here. I think you know, having been to Oxford and studied the canon in the way that it's taught there, there's that whole sort of anxiety of influence that, you know, there's a sort of brilliance that's really prized in places like that, and I'm not sure that that's my way, you know. And I think that the kind of anxiety of wanting to be brilliant, which is, you know, there are very, very brilliant female writers, but I think that sense of being, I don't know, it felt like sort of somewhere for a while I was trying to please some sort of clever man, whoever it was, maybe a male aspect of myself, you know, but and it was when I sort of let go of that, and it comes back to the thing about not having to get it right first time and just writing a kind of like a kind of caps lock, come back to this, that actually it's just really okay to push through. I did an event with somebody recently who was wonderful, and he was an Oxford Don, and he said something about facility and how facility is the enemy, and I kind of, part of me just sort of crumpled up as he said that, because I thought, I actually think that not facility, but a certain allowing yourself a certain ease in writing is actually hugely important to me, not needing it to be brilliant.
Yeah,
you know, as, because it's not going to be brilliant when it, you know, when it comes out, and if you're waiting for it to be brilliant, then I think, well, for me, I just get hidebound by that. I can't be that writer. And I think having that,
I actually that's been one of the most useful things that I've learned as a journalist as well. I had an editor and friend who, because I used to get into sort of tie myself in knots of anguish over something that wasn't working, and she said try and make lighter work of it.
Yeah.
And I found that so helpful. I really relate to what you're saying, that you don't have to beat yourself up until something is perfect in order to move forward.
Exactly that. But there's, again, I think there's a certain sort of, it's not shame is the wrong word, but just that we feel as though if it doesn't, it's really interesting because I'm published in France and the books have been really successful there, which has been amazing because it's a country that I love and I have the most phenomenal publisher there. But when you go and speak to journalists there, they don't have the master's. They're just starting in France. But, you know, obviously there's been a huge kind of explosion of them over here. And it's a very American model. It started in Iowa in the 50s. And it's been in American universities for a long time. But in the last decade, we've seen them, you know, everywhere in the UK. But in France, they still don't have that attitude to craft. And I think they really still have that kind of, that, you know, the genius idea, you know, that if it and I think it's actually really liberating that there are so many degrees now, even though of course everybody that does those degrees isn't going to be a published writer, it somehow takes the mystique out of it, that actually it's just about turning up, and sometimes the magic happens in a really potent way, but mostly it doesn't, and that's okay. And being kind to yourself through that process is hugely important. And if you've got a sort of voice on your shoulder telling you it's rubbish, that's not very kind. I think, you know, over time that voice has really quietened down, which is great.
And what are you proudest of when you look back over the years that you've spent writing?
I suppose I'm proudest of writing myself to kind of equilibrium, because I mean, I don't write for therapy, but definitely before I was a writer, I think my life outside my day-to-day life was less happy, actually. There's something about having this space and this practice, you know, which is just, it's where I meet myself, and that's, yeah, it's been a really wonderful thing. And you know, to feel that I will have that. I mean, I love seeing people like Judith Kerr, you know, who just wrote to the end, you know, or you know, these writers who just, they don't retire, you know, and that sense is wonderful. So it's that, and it's also, I'm incredibly proud that I have managed to help to support my family actually through it.
Something to be proud of. Yeah,
I remember reading an article with Sebastian Barry, and a journalist had come to his house, and he kind of put his hand on the table and said, like, I paid for this with a novel, you know, me reading that going, I really want that to be me, you know. Yeah. And that was when I was kind of working the call center and just having that sort of like inner chime of like, oh my goodness, like, wouldn't that be amazing? And to be able to say that, actually, I paid for this table with my novel, it's just like, it makes me feel quite emotional, you know, because I did do my time, you know, waitressing
and on
the phones, you know, and it's a really amazing thing that, you know, you take this, what is it? You're just sitting there kind of in some ways imagining things in some ways, but yeah, and it turns into food and tables.
That was Anna Hope, and you can buy her novels Wake, The Ballroom and Expectation now. We also touched on The Artist's Way by Julia Cameron. It's been out since 1992, so it's not a groundbreaking recommendation, but I do think it's a wonderful book for anyone who's creative and feeling a bit stuck. Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed it, please send it to a friend. And I'll see you for the final episode of the series next week with Black Mirror writer and humorist Charlie Brooker.